2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Hi, I'm KSL's Debbie Worthen. 4 years ago, my son Asher was diagnosed with autism. After getting our footing, we decided it was time to celebrate the news with all of you. And that's how Celebrating the Spectrum was born. Each week, we consult with the experts and others who are learning to navigate life with a loved one who has special needs. This is a place where we find hope, look for solutions, and connect with those working to create a better world of inclusion.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Celebrating the Spectrum. Today, we are talking with Jessie Hewitson, an award-winning journalist, and she is the money and business editor at the I newspaper in London. That's where she lives. She is the mother of two. Her son is autistic. She is the author of a book that I recently finished and loved titled Autism, How to Raise a Happy Autistic Child. Jessie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Debbie. It's my pleasure.
So I would love to hear about you finding out that your son was autistic. We all have this beginning journey of where things all started. What were the signs you were seeing? How old was he and how were you feeling?
Yeah, so my son was born different to some of the other kids. You know, so I belong to a group. In the UK, we call it NCT group. I don't know what you have in the US, but essentially you become friends with mums that are pregnant at the same time. And so you've got a friendship group and all your children at the same age. So when this group and I used to meet up and we all had babies, there was a clear difference between mine and the others. So, for example, I mean, the differences were things that I couldn't articulate or pinpoint or, you know, sort of explain clearly. But in retrospect, now I know what those differences were. They were that my son didn't make eye contact. He found it difficult to engage in the way that I wanted him to engage. And I remember actually when someone used the word disengaged with my son, it was a real light bulb moment because it was like, yes, that's it. That's what is so difficult for us. He also cried a lot of the time. And I just found it really difficult to read him, I think. It's sort of all that sort of instinctiveness that you're meant to have when you're a mum seemed to sort of elude me. So he did seem, I instinctively knew he wasn't happy. And I remember saying to people when he was 6 months old, I don't think my baby's happy. And they like looked at me like I was completely insane. Like, why would you be wondering whether your baby is happy or not? But I think what I was trying to articulate was I knew something was tough and challenging for him. And I was right in that instinct, you know, and I later found out why. But yeah, essentially, I found it difficult to play with him in a way that he enjoyed. And, you know, that sort of reciprocal to and fro just wasn't there. So I used to like copy what other people were doing with their babies and try it with my son, and it didn't work. So, you know, sort of doing all those kind of funny faces, mm-hmm. he didn't respond to that or do it back or even enjoy it. So it was just like all the normal things, like taking him to the music classes, didn't work. He hated the music classes. You know, he used to cry and he actually used to try and escape them. But I just used to bring him back to the thing that he was trying to escape because I just kept trying to do the normal thing.
Now, is he your oldest?
Yes, he is.
So that, I think, presents challenges as well because you don't even really know what you're looking at. I think it's really critical that you have that friend group because you were able, because, you know, you only know your own kid. So you kind of only know in your own house how things are going. But to be watching those other moms and thinking, okay, this, like, he's not connecting the way that these other kids are. Something must be going on. I mean, that had to be how you were feeling. Or were you feeling like this was your fault?
Well, the latter, actually. So so I put everything on my parenting. I thought that was the problem, and that I wasn't kind of working hard enough, or I just wasn't a good enough parent. Oh. And so I actually found meeting this group really difficult. And in the end, over time, actually, I stopped meeting them, because especially when, you know, my son wasn't, you know, sort of talking at the age you would expect him to, and his communication was delayed. I just found it too painful, really, to see what was going on. So, it wasn't actually that helpful, because really it was just, you know, painful and difficult. Yeah. But I think you're absolutely right. I think when it's your first child and you don't know what, you know, so-called normal is, mm-hmm. you know, and everyone tells you parenting's tough. I just thought, you know, I was going through the usual difficulties.
Yeah, you thought, you're right, this is tough. And I know what you mean as far as those milestones, because I have definitely had those moments of sadness where my son is missing those milestones. We talk about that on the show sometimes here, because when our kids, our autistic kids, just blow past a milestone, you know, that no other kid is doing, we just like shout that from the rooftops. And we're not being those parents that think our kids are geniuses. We're being those parents that finally have our moment, you know, that's to really celebrate that. Because I do think it is painful at times, especially at the beginning when you're watching all of these babies, you're watching all of these kids do these things. And mainly you're just like, number one, what am I doing wrong? Am I not giving my son the things that he needs? And then number two, someone else could be doing this better. Yeah, I mean, at least that's how I felt at times. Did you experience that?
Oh, completely. I mean, completely. It was really quite a dark place, really. And I, you know, I still struggle with that. You know, I think maternal guilt is, you know, is a very real thing. But I think if you've got a child with differences, I think it's kind of compounded.
No, I agree. You say in the, I think it was in the foreword of this book, that this is the book you wish you had been able to read when your son was first diagnosed. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so my son was diagnosed just after he was two. It was, in the UK at least, this is considered very early. And the reason why we got onto it relatively quickly was, well, partly because he was just a sort of quite a textbook case of being autistic, I think. So when everyone said, oh, my God, you know, that's really young to be diagnosed, I actually always thought, well, no, it isn't. You know, we've spent the last 2 years you know, sort of struggling, really. You know, in retrospect, I think all the hallmarks were there from birth. But anyway, so yeah, so my mother-in-law was an educational psychologist, and she was retired at this point, but she was the one who said, have you considered autism? And
How did you know when she said that?
Well, I knew absolutely nothing about autism, but I remember thinking, that must be it. You know, that must be the difference I instinctively felt, you know. And I remember going on YouTube and looking up autism and seeing a child stimming, so flapping their hands, which was exactly what my son did. But I've always thought that was like some funny quirk that my son did. And then suddenly realizing this was characteristic of an autistic kid. And I shut the laptop and burst into tears. Mm. So it was all very conflicting. I was terrified that he was autistic, but I think there was a bit of me that was also relieved that it wasn't my fault, that there might be something else going on, that it wasn't all about my parenting. So, you know, so it was very, very complicated. And I think also on the one hand, I was desperate for him to not be autistic, because at the time I had quite unenlightened views about what autism is. But also at the same time, I was desperate that the pediatricians were going to say, actually, there's nothing going on here, which would have just left me struggling with a child who I was finding it difficult to engage and communicate with. So it was really complicated.
I agree. It's a complicated time, because we've heard there's so much misinformation out there, and information with autism has been evolving dramatically, as you now know, over the past several years. And so how long have you been a journalist? Because I want to share a story with you from 20 years ago. Have you been doing this like all of your adult life?
Yeah, 20 plus years. Yeah.
Yeah. So 20 years ago, I was a field reporter and I was doing a story on autism. And at the time, autism wasn't covered by insurance. Autism services weren't. And there was this family, this very affluent family, and they had two autistic kids. And I didn't have any kids yet. And they were drowning in debt from these two kids. Not only that, they literally could like never get the resources that they needed. They could never leave the house because no one could handle their kids. I remember looking at that scenario and just thinking, please, I hope that is never my lot in life, you know? And that was one of my first like real life one-on-one experiences with autism. So even when I was pregnant, I just remember thinking, I can handle anything. I can't handle autism. I can't handle that. And this is in the back of my mind this whole time. And then we adopted our son, Asher. I was so in love with that kid. You could have told me anything and it wouldn't have even mattered, you know? However, when we started looking at the markers for autism and they started saying you need to do some additional testing, just wasn't what I thought autism looked like. Did you feel that way? I had a different view of autism in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you about that sort of not wanting your kid to be autistic. It's funny, I had that too when I was pregnant. And I think it has become the real sort of fear of parents actually now. And I think when I was writing the book, I was really unpicking it in my head what that's about. And I think it's because we associate autism with misery and having a deeply unhappy life and being sort of blocked off from the world. And, you know, a lot of the books I was reading, there was a child like sort of cut off from its parents almost, like with, and it was just a really horrible picture of autism. And so I realized actually when I was writing this book that I wasn't scared about autism per se. I was scared about having a really unhappy child and by extension being really unhappy myself, because I don't know if you've got the saying in the US, but you know, it is true that you're as happy as your unhappiest child. And so, you know, I felt scared by it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I also going to Google and reading other books just terrified me even further, really. So when I had this book, I'm going to be somebody who's, you know, a parent of an autistic child that writes, you know, everything I learned and puts it in one good place. And I remember speaking to an autistic adult, because when I used to work for the Times newspaper of London. And as part of that, I interviewed a famous autistic adult. This was nothing to do with the book. This was just my day job at the Times. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying to him, I'm going to write a book about, you know, having an autistic kid. And he was so rude to me and unimpressed that I was writing this book. Now, I was expecting him to be like grateful.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, thank you. But actually, he was like, oh, my God, not another parent writing about, you know, your parents' viewpoint. That is like the last thing we need, was kind of what he said to me. And it really shook me. And I remember sort of asking him, well, why are you so sort of negative about what I'm going to do? And he said, well, you know, we've got enough of that and you don't really understand what's going on. And nobody's interested in speaking to autistic people. And that's where the real truth lies. Mm-hmm. And so I went back and thought, oh my God, he's right. And actually started, I reached out to an autistic woman on Twitter and said, can we have a phone conversation? And I spoke to her and just within 10 minutes, I'd had this completely amazing phone conversation. And I think just the act of speaking to someone who was autistic, and actually she and I have become really good friends now, was so helpful, because suddenly I started making friends with autistic people. And so the fear evaporated. And, you know, the idea of my son becoming like them was not scary in the least. In fact, these were people, you know, I really enjoyed spending time with. and also getting their viewpoint about autism. That is, actually, being autistic is absolutely fine. The problem is, you know, it's something that comes with challenges. It's something that comes with, like, advantages. But the difficulty is when everyone thinks you're wrong somehow, or you should be, you know, conducting your life in a different way. That's the problem. And so, you know, for example, I think there are comparisons that can be made with the gay community. You know, like, I think often, you know, I think to how people in the 50s maybe would find out that their child was gay and think, oh, my God, this is their life's over. You know, they're not going to marry. They're not going to have kids. They'll have a dreadful life because of this and the, you know, et cetera, et cetera. When really they just led a different life that was equally happy and fulfilling. It was just different to what everyone expected.
Right. And aren't you so relieved that we live in today's day and age where we are recognizing all of these amazing qualities and traits that the autistic people have in our life? And I would not even say it's a deficit now. It's a difference. And in many ways, it's better than neurotypical. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think I don't think it's a deficit at all. I think there's as many varied autistic people as there are non-autistic people. I think it's kind of a nonsense now to talk about autistic people. And I think when, you know, our X, Y, and Z, I think once you meet autistic people, you realize how daft it is because you realize the kind of true meaning of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't consider it a deficit. I feel incredibly strongly that, you know, if we were, like, say, to invent a cure for autism, you know, Temple Grandin did say, put it very well, that the person who invented the wheel was likely to be autistic because the non-autistic people would have been just chatting by the campfire, you know, getting not much done. But I think there, you know, it is true. A lot of the advancements have probably relied on that sort of autistic focus on detail. And, you know, the kind of special interests, we say, which are just really about perfecting something and getting to know everything about it.
Right, right. So I really liked in your book where you talked about sensory differences, and you go into that in some pretty good detail. So you go through some of those most common, frequently asked questions. How much would this section have helped you when you were navigating those first days with your son?
Yeah, so I wish I'd known far more about sensory differences. I mean, the fact that my son was crying when he was a baby was because I was taking him in noisy environments and he couldn't cope with all the sort of noises. So so sensory differences is possibly the most important thing to wrap your head around, I think, because I think it's really tricky to understand that someone's sensory experience is different from yours. And I think, you know, for example, like if I close my eyes, you know, I sort of know where my limbs are. But if my son does that, he doesn't. And how that must make you feel, like you're floating in space, you know, and also, you know, not being able to drown out background noise. And, you know, it gives you a sort of a lot more sympathy, really. And I think it helps you understand meltdowns a lot better and why, if your child is going through a meltdown, don't sort of keep talking at them, because that just sort of, you know, speaking to someone verbally, if they've got, you know, a condition that makes it harder for them to communicate, just gives them one extra thing to have to deal with at a time when they're finding it very difficult. So we've got something, is it occupational therapy? Do you have that as well?
Yes.
In the US? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wish, like, a lot, when we first found out Ellis was autistic, a lot of our money really went into, you know, so dubious therapies that really were about trying to make him look non-autistic. And I wish I'd done none of that. I wish I'd put it into occupational therapy to understand what was going on for him and to help sort of modify his environment so his, like, sensory experiencing wasn't overwhelming him. Mm-hmm. And it needs way much more research. I think the reason why we don't know more about the sensory experience of autistic people is because non-autistic people have led research. And I think had autistic people being in the forefront of research, that would be the first thing they would be looking at. Because when I asked autistic people, it was the sensory experience that was the hardest to deal with. And I think so much of that is what causes anxiety. And also I think you know, with my own son, I think trying to deal with his anxiety is like 90% of the problem. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I loved in your book when you talked about all this money that's been spent over the years, millions of dollars on curing, fixing autism, when really the shift needs to be, all those dollars need to be spent on figuring this part out, figuring out how to accommodate and work with these sensory issues.
Yeah. And I think also it's really important, because I think traditional sort of interventions have been about making someone appear more non-autistic, with the assumption that that's going to help them in their life, you know, like in their workplace, and be, you know, have a more successful life. Now, I totally get the kind of the sort of premise, really, you know, like we've all been brought up to think in order to be happy, you get a job, you know, you're able to hold down that job, you find a wife, et cetera, et cetera. And it had been assumed that, you know, in order to equip someone who's autistic, you need to build those skills. And if they can, you know, sort of appear less autistic at work, then that's going to help them at work. But actually, what we're increasingly realizing is that if you encourage your autistic child to appear non-autistic, then really you're just, you know, it's creating mental health problems. And I know that sounds dramatic for parents, but I think we do know that, you know, the sort of gap between who you really are and who you appear, the bigger that gap is, the more likely you are going to have mental health problems. So I think, you know, with masking is that gap. So masking is when autistic people pretend to be someone other than who they are, often non.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
They pretend to be non-autistic, and masking is really something that doesn't help people. So I think as parents, it really helps to be aware of the subtle ways you kind of encourage your child to mask. I mean, this is what I think of, because example, I would love my child to be popular at school. That would mean everything to me, because I sort of see him being popular equals I've been a successful parent and they're happy, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas actually he's never going to be popular. That's just not my son. He's not hugely fussed about having friends over in the weekend. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really want to do it. And I think in the playground, you know, he does want friendships, mm-hmm. and he does want people to play with, but you know, he's not going to be that person that's going to be in a group of 20 people and loving it, really. Yeah. So for him, it's always going to be about sort of select friendships. But yet, because he wasn't popular at school, I was there sort of doing all the play dates and putting all this pressure on him, really. Go and speak to them, you know. And actually, I think that was putting pressure on him to be something he wasn't, which was the sort of the kid that could thrive in a neurotypical society with social ease that he just wasn't born with. So I think in a way, what I'm trying now is to say it's okay not to it's fine not to want to spend your weekends with the same people you see at school. It's fine not to be invited to birthday parties. And when that happened to me, it used to crush me. But yeah, now.
And he maybe doesn't even care. You know, that's what we start learning.
Quite possibly. I mean, I also think I find it hard to unpick, actually, because I think he is very sensitive. Mm-hmm. And I think I think there is an aspect of him that does care about it, but I find it very hard to know how much is me caring and him
right.
caring.
Projecting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, we need to take a quick break. So we will take a quick break. When we come back, we want to talk about building your team and the importance of high expectations and a few other things. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Thanks for being with us. We are talking with Jesse Hewitson today, author of a book that I found on Instagram and absolutely connected with and loved. It is called Autism, How to Raise a Happy Autistic Child. So, Jesse, you talked a little bit about interventions just in the last couple of minutes. Let's talk about building your team. Can you explain this? I have found this is kind of always evolving in our life as far as who I feel like are really our true teammates.
Yeah. So I think if you've got an autistic child or, you know, any kind of child with a disability, you're going to need extra help. And so, you know, in an ideal world, that could come from your family, although I think that's quite a complex area. I think lots of people I speak to find their parents, you know, don't always get it or need a bit more sort of help understanding it. But so essentially what I found is that building your team is finding the people and the professionals who are going to help your kid be happy. So just to add, in terms of interventions, I think the best focus is to how can I make my child be happy? And so if you make that the goal, so it's about working out which professionals really get your child, which professionals does your child like to be around, and, you know, choosing them. So, for example, we've got a nanny, you know, someone who picks up my child from school. And she's worked with us forever, really. And so she's someone I can absolutely trust. She's definitely on our team. You know, if she left us, I'd have to grieve because I couldn't cope with it at all. And then we've also got we've got an occupational therapist that comes around to our house who gives brilliant advice. She's on our team as well. And I think I mentioned my friend who is an autistic author called Laura James, and she's written the most amazing book called Odd Girl Out. And I'd really recommend it. And she is brilliant because when stuff's going on, I can sometimes WhatsApp her or text her or speak to her and say, what should I do?
Oh,
and
she gives man, what a resource.
I know. I mean, actually, one of my dreams is to, you know, have like a Facebook group where it's autistic adults giving advice to, you know, parents yeah. who don't know what on earth to do with their autistic children.
Right.
So, for example, I think there was a period of time when Alice was screaming quite a lot. And I remember sort of messaging her saying, I don't know how to deal with it, really. And she said, write down, you can't scream because screaming hurts people's ears and they won't want to talk to you anymore. I mean, it sounds quite blunt, but that's how she put it. And so I wrote it down and put it up on the wall. And I think it was a far more logical explanation than or far more logical approach than I would have done it. So she made it visual, sorry. Mm-hmm. It wasn't verbal. It didn't involve me talking him through it. And it was a clear, logical explanation. So that's one good example. So for that reason, Laura is very much on my team as well.
Yeah, no, the team, I think, is critical. And then when it comes to high expectations, tell me your take on that.
Yeah, so high expectations is everything because, you know, a lot of autistic kids, but not all, have this kind of spiky profile, which means there are things they will struggle at and there are things they'll be sort of really good at. Mm-hmm. So I think in the past, you know, if people, you know, see your child as autistic, teachers, they don't have very high expectations for them. So in the UK, they might be palmed off with a teaching assistant who isn't very trained and nobody's really trying to push that child academically, for example. And I think also if a child doesn't have a particularly consistent academic profile, there might be an assumption to think, oh, well, they're not all that bright, for example. So it's about, you know, it's about having the same expectations as you would for a non-disabled person, really, I think, and working from there. And that doesn't mean that all your expectations have to be academic, but it could mean just finding what that child is really brilliant at. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, that is such a service for that child, because it gives them something that they're really good at. And I think, you know, disabled children are not given that as much as they should be. You know, that feeling of not failing a lot. I mean, the autistic adults that I spoke to, that was such a common narrative of feeling like you were failing at life. And I think things are rightfully moving towards trying to work with people's strengths. Mm-hmm. Sort of not just spending all the time trying to help somebody with something that they really find hard, because and spending more time on something that they're really good at. And right. I think it's a sort of key difference, because when they're adults, they're not going to be doing that thing they find hard.
Right.
Most likely they're going to be doing that thing that they feel good at. And I think also that's a real source of confidence, isn't it?
For sure. I mean, we all are like that. We all feel that same way.
We need something, don't we?
Yeah. We had an author on recently, and he had done this study. Well, he had studied kids for 50 years, and one kid that he was working at, they found this way because he loved license plates, could memorize license plates. So he was working with the teacher. How can we use that strength of his memorization as an interest to succeed in this project they're doing? And it became just this huge win-win for everyone in the school. For the child, he interviewed the teachers, got their license plate numbers, took the pictures, did the presentation. So he felt amazing with the job that he did on the project, and everyone learned about the teacher. So it was really cool. All right.
That's really it. I mean, I also think, I hate generalizing, but you know, among my son, and I've noticed this about some autistic adults, that this urge, this real need to please people, I think can be very much there among autistic kids. So I think that plays into that.
Right. No, I love that accommodation, how it ended up being just so cool for everyone involved. All right. So the title of your book is really one of the main reasons I ordered it. You know, the name of our podcast is Celebrating the Spectrum. That was not an accident. That was on purpose. And I felt a connection to you because you seemed really like my kind of person when it comes to navigating this new world. And so when you look at anxiety, because anxiety is a big issue for my son as well, how do you identify that? Because like you were saying, I feel like the anxiety is what leads to him eloping at school, or, you know, having semi meltdowns at home. Our expectations are just so much lower than in a school setting, so we don't see as much of that. And he learned in some therapy, like space please, that's the what they use. It's like, leave me alone, which my husband and I just think is so hilarious to use at any time because everyone needs that. But how do you identify anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I was thinking about this. One of the ways I do notice it is that when he's not anxious, and I have to be honest, he's that doesn't happen often. Mm-hmm. You know, he is a child with high anxiety. But I do notice when he starts kind of bouncing as he walks, that's when the anxiety's lessened. So
when you're starting to see that kick in, is there something that you do where you're like, okay, I can see this is about to happen, and here's how I have found it successful to bring that down and help him regulate?
Yeah, I think the best thing I can say is that, yeah, I think that trying to cure anxiety is not the way to go about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a very anxious person myself, and I think it was the one thing I wanted for my child was not to be anxious. Mm.
So because you've dealt with that forever.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not nice, and it makes you exhausted, and you waste so much time on it. But of course, my son is very anxious. And so I think I threw myself into solving it. And I think now I've come to realize he's always going to be anxious. It's just about giving him strategies to deal with that anxiety. So, And also, now he's 12, really, it's really about helping him deal with that anxiety himself. Mm-hmm. So I think being aware that he does need a lot of time to himself, I think that's definitely helps him. And I think getting the right school has been so key. I mean, my son is now at a special school. I don't know if you've got the right same terminology, but what it means is that he's in a school for autistic kids.
Okay.
And I think I'd put off him moving to a special school because I wanted him to be in the normal school. Mm-hmm. But actually, I wish I'd done it a long time ago because he's benefiting from it a great deal.
Interesting. And you can tell he's happier.
He's happier, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I do think he's still anxious a lot of the time. And I think trying to help him articulate that is really important because he finds it so hard to know what emotions he's feeling and put words to it. So I think I'm there quite a lot of the time saying, do you know, I think maybe you're not feeling this. You know, you think you're crying because you're exhausted. Mm-hmm. But I actually think maybe you're crying because this happened.
Right.
Yeah. Or maybe you're incredibly hungry. I think he doesn't know when he's hungry.
Yeah.
He doesn't know when he's frustrated, angry. It all gets lumped together as I'm feeling something horrible and yeah. I've got a headache because it's got right. to something really extreme and I haven't known what I was feeling. So I haven't right. been able to do anything about it.
Yeah.
And I also found like different techniques. I think not using words helps, which I find quite difficult because I'm very chatty. But when he was younger, we used to have a little book and I'd write down something, a message to him. How are you feeling? You know, if something had really upset him, and he would write something back to me and leave it on my bed. And then I would take that notebook and write something. We'd have a conversation, but in a notebook. And I think, you know, I'd love to say we had huge revelations. I'm not sure we did, but I do think he was able to write a few things down that he would have found hard to say to me verbally. And I've interviewed parents who do it when their children are older on texts. Mm-hmm. They find, you know, doing it on the mobile phone much easier than expecting someone to have a conversation right. with you about their feelings.
Right.
And I think, you know, there is something very unstructured and very verbal about, let's sit down and talk about this. And I think for my son, actually, that probably is the absolute last thing.
That's the worst.
Yeah. And I think it feels punishing. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, don't really expect this kind of heart to heart all the time. Just try and find different ways of doing it. And it might, it might not be verbally.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's great insight. So school's definitely been the hardest thing that we've encountered for many reasons. So I love how you kind of go over the pros and cons for different types of schools and classes within schools. So support in education. And it's interesting to hear that because we do have limited schools for only autistic kids here in Utah, you know, in the West. And I wish there were more. And so what advice would you have for parents whose kids are autistic, who are trying to navigate this whole education part of this? And I know we could probably do an entire podcast on this, but what have you found to be helpful, successful, not just specifically in your son's situation, but kind of in general from the people that you've talked to?
Yeah, I think the school thing is like the toughest issue a lot of us face. So I assume it's the same in the US. Teachers don't understand autism as well as you would like them to on the whole. So there's a real gap in understanding. And I think also schools over here are really stretched. They don't have much money. Mm-hmm. You know, they get money to support your kid, but that money isn't always spent on your kid.
Right.
So it's a system that's kind of almost set up for conflict. But so what I've found is when my son was in a typical school, I just had to make peace with the fact that I was going to have to always be on the school's back. And that was my approach. And I, you know, didn't enjoy doing it. Right. But if I didn't do it, he wasn't going to get the support he needed. Mm-hmm. And so that meant that I had to learn really sort of management techniques in a way of communicating to school. And I also had to work out how to communicate best with the school who are, you know, we're largely trying their best.
So, yes. Oh, for sure. And you talked about the team at my son's school now, I love, I mean, they are amazing. They're trying, they're creative. they're working with him, you know, and it has come with some, what's the right word? Assertive parenting, I guess, maybe you could say, but I do feel like they love him. Truly. They love him. They want what's best for him. And we're making progress. But as I've talked to other parents, I don't think this is the norm. I think that generally it's right. an uphill battle.
Yeah. So yes, I think often parents do feel that the schools aren't doing what they need to be done to make their child mm-hmm. happy. And I think the biggest problem is often autistic people don't feel safe at school or, you know, heard, valued, all those other things going on. Mm-hmm. So I think choosing your battles is one important thing. I think if you're sort of sending those emails to the school too often, you know, schools can start sort of stop hearing you. I remember a very wise person said to me that if you get angry with someone, all they hear is the anger. They don't hear what it is you're trying to say to them. So I think, you know, if you, you know, picking your battles and the things that really matter, you know, email, you know, quite a sort of direct email saying, you know, this happened today. This is why I don't think it should have happened. This was the effect on my son. Could we have a conversation about this? And I think trying to work with the school as much as possible, but also I think in retrospect, I was often trying to sort of, I'm a bit of a people pleaser and I don't like falling out with people. So I was there trying to sort of protect my relationship with the school. But actually now we left the primary school, I sort of think, well, you know, you're there for 6 years. I mean, you don't have to, you know, you need to get on with people. But I think at the same time, I had to accept actually that I was going to be a bit of a pain to the school because I was going to be sort of making them sort of work a bit harder mm-hmm. because, you know, they've got too many kids to look after as it is. But I just needed them to do certain things for my son. So, yeah, it did involve me having to have those quite sort of awkward conversations with them saying, OK, you said you were going to do this. I understand it's not being done. You know, can we make sure it happens from now onwards? Those kind of conversations, kind of to the point, non-moany conversations. Because I think also what can happen is when you've got an autistic child in the UK, often you find you've had to battle your way through the whole system, you know, getting them diagnosed, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And often what I think sometimes happens is parents then offload a lot of this onto schools and teachers. And it's too much. So I think try to sort of only sort of address one thing rather than, you know, sort of being too ranty. If
that's great advice. That really is. I think that I have been guilty of just coming in really hot at times, too, because, well, I've had this experience and we're not going to have that, you know, all of that. And that's probably not the best approach.
Yeah.
All right. So what would you like people to know? What is your hope for the future?
Well, I'd love... My hope for the future is that autistic people are, you know, better understood, I guess. That schools are very different places because I worry a lot about the experience of autistic children in school. And, you know, if I can just take empathy, for example, I find this, like, I think the whole notion of empathy has really been used as a club to sort of hammer autistic people unfairly. So, in the UK, there's a man called Simon Baron-Cohen, who's like a sort of professor in psychology, and he's done a lot of the research in empathy, which has shown that in some respects, autistic people can have slightly different levels of empathy, let's say. But actually, when you look into this research, what you'll find is that there are two components to empathy. One is that I instinctively get what you're going through. I just somehow know what you're feeling emotionally at this time. The second component to empathy is once I know that you're going through a tough time, I want to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And with some autistic people won't have the first instinctive part, but they very much have the second part. And so this is why autistic people are the opposite to psychopaths, if I can draw that mm-hmm. comparison, because psychopaths will understand instinctively what you're going through, but they won't be moved to do anything about it. They won't care that you're going through a tough experience. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like this stereotype of autistic people is that they're unempathetic, and it's just not true. It may be that an autistic person doesn't understand straight away or instinctively that you're having a tough day, but if you explain that to them, they may have an extremely sensitive response to how your day has been and really want to do something about it. Or they may not, you know, because autistic people are human and some are nice.
Right.
But my point is there's this sort of notion that autistic people are somehow like less than human because they don't care and they're not empathetic, and it is so untrue.
Yes.
And I just wish people realized, you know, how autistic people are every bit as sensitive as non-autistic people. Or there's lots of not very sensitive non-autistic people and vice versa. We're all very different. But I think if people realize that a lot of the stereotypes are just completely untrue, that would be a good starting point.
Thank you so much. Where can people get your book?
Amazon is a good place, I would imagine.
That's where I got it.
And also, I'm so pleased that people in the US, like, it was a real surprise to get your email to know that you were in the US reading my book. So I'm absolutely delighted. Thank you.
Well, I saw it was an autistic influencer on Instagram who said, these are the 5 books you must read. So I ordered 2 because I couldn't afford all 5 at once. I ordered 2 and... yeah, I just really, really loved yours. So thank you so much for joining us today, for your insight and the work that you're doing to create a world of inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Celebrating the Spectrum is a KSL podcast.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.